Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, December 12, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we'll be discussing Elon Werman's new book, A Debt Against the Living, An Introduction to Originalism. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Professor Michael W. McConnell, Richard and Francis Mallory Professor and Director of the Constitutional Law Center at Stanford Law School, and Elon Werman, author of A Debt Against the Living and Associate at Winston & Strawn. He's also Visiting Fellow at the Stanford Constitutional Law Center. After opening remarks from Professor McConnell, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Professor. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Laura. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk to folks about this interesting new book. I've been teaching now for, 30-some-odd years, and one of the most common questions I get from new students, from members of the public, and often from parents of students is there an accessible book to read about how to understand the Constitution, about constitutional law? And I've in the past had to somewhat scratch my head and say, well, you know, there are a lot of books that are good books that teach you a lot, but I can't really recommend a single short, accessible book that would serve as an introduction to the topic. Well, now I have a good answer to that, because Elon Werman's book, A Debt Against the Living, is a perfect quick introduction to constitutional law, that is, how to read the Constitution. It's not so much about the substance of the Constitution as it is about that all-important question of how do we interpret it, who has interpretive authority, what sense can we make of this, you know, 230-some-odd-year-old document. And so this is the book to read if you're heading to law school and you need to inoculate yourself against your first-year con law professor. It's the book to give to your son or daughter if they're heading off to law school, and it's the book for any citizen to read if you'd just like to have a guide to the perplexed for hearing about constitutional arguments. Elon, why don't you just tell them a good bit more about your book?
Sure, and thanks for that wonderful introduction. I'm both you, Professor McConnell, and Laura. I don't plan to take up too much of everyone's time before we open it up for questions. So I'll just say a little bit about what gap I think this book fills. Michael spoke a little bit about that in terms of its gap, its role as sort of this introduction. But I also think it is an introduction, but it's kind of a flavored introduction. I do stake out some positions. Some are probably more controversial than I let on in the book. So I'll talk a little bit, again, just briefly about the gap I think it fills in terms of the argument. So I'll just give a sort of a truncated version of the talk that I give to students and lawyers chapters on the argument to show where I think it fills sort of that gap. And maybe Professor McConnell, maybe you'll chime back in and disagree with me on some things. So Professor McConnell suggested that the first gap is that it's this introduction. It's only 135 pages. It's intended to be this sort of distillation of 40 years of originalist scholarship. What are the, yes, there are disagreements. What are the areas of disagreement? But there are also these general findings and conclusions about originalism. What do a lot of people agree about? And the reason I wrote this book is I don't know what the demographic range of the listeners on this call is, but I assume most of you had similar experiences to me in law school, which is we're rarely actually taught about these issues in law school. I mean, if you're lucky enough to have Professor McConnell, who happens to be teaching a seminar on it, then maybe your experience is a bit different. But in the ordinary constitutional law classes, we don't really get this. And part of the reason, I think, is the case method itself, which lends itself to this sort of understanding that constitutional law is just done in a precedential, evolutionary, piecemeal, sort of living constitutionalist kind of way. And if you happen to encounter an originalist decision, like D.C. v. Heller, then maybe your professor will talk for 10 minutes about originalism and its alternative, and then that's that. And so that was actually my experience. I think I had a sum total of 10 minutes of classroom instruction in all 3 years of law school on originalism or its alternatives. And so what I had to do was what most of you all had to do and most other students have to do who are interested in this, is you have to kind of strike it out on your own. And so I looked for an introduction, but I couldn't really find one. I mean, there are great books written on it, as Professor McConnell said, Randy Barnett's book, Keith Whittington's book, Jack Balkin, and terrific articles as well. Professor McConnell's written great articles, Gary Lawson, others. But no, single narrative introduction. Again, it's only 135 pages in this sort of a distillation of the findings and conclusions of 40 years of originalism. But so at the highest level, that's what I was sort of attempting to do with this book. But I do think it fills something of a gap in its argument as well. And that's because the book makes the case for the founding and for the founders, because the claim I make is that we can't fully defend originalism without also defending the founding. And before I unpack that, it's actually a good point to talk about the title and where the title comes from, A Debt Against the Living. This comes from an exchange between Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. Many people are familiar with Jefferson's initial letter to Madison in 1789, in which Thomas Jefferson said that the earth belongs to the living, and not to the dead. The dead have neither power nor rights over it. One generation is to another, as an independent nation to another. This letter, Jefferson's dead hand letter, so to speak, has been quoted today quite often for the proposition that we shouldn't be bound by the dead hand of the past, by the dead hand of the Constitution. But less known is Madison's reply, in which he makes a powerful response. And so Madison says the following: if the earth be the gift of nature to the living, then their title can extend to the earth in its natural state only. The improvements made by the dead form a debt against the living, who take the benefit of them. This debt, Madison continued, cannot be otherwise discharged than by a proportionate obedience to the will of the authors of the improvement. Translation: yeah, Jefferson, you know, the earth certainly does belong to the living, but only in its natural condition. The Constitution is an improvement of such magnitude, of such consequence upon the natural condition of the world, that posterity who take the benefit of that improvement, it forms this debt against them, a debt against the living. And the only way we, the living, Madison said, can faithfully discharge that debt is through a kind of originalism, a proportionate obedience to the will of the authors of the improvement. So that's the set piece for the book. Who's right, Thomas Jefferson or James Madison? And, by my choice of title and I guess presence here today, you can all guess or infer that I answer in favor of, Madison, originalism, and the original Constitution. But the title, A Debt Against the Living, that's the choice of title because I think to make the case, we have to argue that the Constitution today still creates this debt against the living generation. And that if it doesn't create this debt, then maybe that's a case for non-originalism. And I think this fills something of a gap in the literature, because most of the literature, especially the law review literature, focuses on another question, on something else. The literature, for the most part, focuses on how to interpret texts, how to interpret legal texts in particular, how do we interpret contracts, how do we interpret statutes, or how do we interpret text more generally, intended for a public audience or intended as a public instruction. Like Gary Lawson has this very entertaining law review article called On Reading Recipes and Constitutions, in which he draws an analogy saying, interpreting the Constitution is really no different than interpreting a recipe for fried chicken. You know, it's a text intended as a public instruction, and so you interpret it the way the public to whom it was directed as an instruction would interpret it. And this is its original public meaning, and interpreting a Constitution is no different. And I think that's all right. And I canvassed that literature in one of the early chapters, and I certainly agree with that literature. But I don't think it gets us far enough, because I think, and Professor McConnell might disagree with me on this in particular, but I think non-originalism, properly understood in its best light, would take all of those arguments, would take that literature, and would say, okay, well, that's all beside the point. The best non-originalist argument, I think, would go as follows. We don't dispute that there is this thing called original public meaning. We just dispute that the original public meaning should be the law. We'll even grant you that ordinarily we interpret statutes with the original public meaning, or contracts with the original public meaning, or interpret fried chicken recipes with the original public meaning. But they'll say the Constitution is different. You can't just abandon the Constitution the way you can abandon a fried chicken recipe that's no longer any good. And it's also very hard to amend. It's much harder to amend than an ordinary statute. So they'll say, we'll grant you that ordinarily we give legal effect to the original public meaning of the law, but even if that's true, the Constitution is different because the Constitution is old and needs to be updated, the argument will go, and it's very hard to do that updating, to do that changing and that amending in the process, through the process that we would ordinarily use for things like statutes or a recipe. Their argument would be that non-originalism is not a crazy way to affect constitutional change. Now, this, some non-originalists would say, well, no, we're doing interpretation. But again, I think the honest non-originalists acknowledge that what they're doing is constitutional change in a way that's not crazy when you think about it. It's the three coordinate branches of government all acting together. It's judges using their independent judgment, not just to assess how the constitutional rules should apply in the modern world, but they look to direction from the political branches, from what Congress is doing and thinks is constitutional, from what the president is doing and thinks is constitutional. And, you know, they try to draw inspiration from that. And the president, you know, the political branches are at least indirectly and, you know, directly responsive to popular sentiment up to some degree. And this isn't a crazy way, then, to change a constitution that's old, needs changing, and that's very hard to change by other means. So that's the best non-originalist argument, I think. And if that's right, or at least if someone is persuaded by that, then I think, you know, the Gary Lawsons and Larry Solomons get us most of the way there, but not all of the way there, because the non-originalists will say that's all beside the point. The only way, I think, that we can respond to this non-originalist position best understood is through a defense of the founding. I think we have to defend the original legal content of the Constitution. We have to defend that content in order to make the case that we should still be bound by the original public meaning of the Constitution. We have to answer the question, does this Constitution create a debt against the living today? And if so, I think that's the reason that we should continue to interpret it the way we interpret our other laws, because its original legal content should still be the law. So the book has two central chapters trying to make this case. I mean, how do we even answer that question? It seems to be a much harder question than the question of how to interpret just any legal text. I mean, how do we even go about figuring out whether the Constitution creates this debt? And so I try to answer it by asking, well, what does a constitution have to do to be a good constitution for a free society? And so the argument that I make, and based on the founders' view, and I think the founders were right, is that the Constitution principally has to balance the two competing objectives, the two principal ends of government. On the one hand, has to create a constitution for a free society, has to create a regime of self-government, one in which we the people can govern ourselves through our elected representatives and decide what kind of people we want to be, politically, culturally, socially, morally, you know, economically. And on the other hand, a constitution for a free society also has to protect a large measure of natural liberty, because why would we, you know, come out of the state of nature and into this raw deal called society if it stripped away our natural liberty? And so these are the two objectives, but they're in tension with each other, because it's, you know, as you all know, often the popular majorities that infringe on the rights of the minorities. And one can pull some inspiration from Edmund Burke here, by the way, who, in a nice passage that I'm unfortunately only going to paraphrase, he said it's very easy to form a government. Compel obedience and the work is done. And it's equally easy, Burke said, to create freedom. All that requires is to let go the rein. But to form a free government, and that is a constitution for government that combines and balances these two competing objectives in a coherent and consistent work, requires a powerful and combining mind. So in the book, I don't have to go into this now, but in the book, I make the case that the founders were remarkably successful at accomplishing this objective and balancing these two principal ends of government through ingenious mechanisms that you all know and that I don't have to rehearse, things like the separation of powers, checks and balances, the enumeration of powers and the division of federal and state power. The Bill of Rights and the representative mechanism itself, by the way, was novel at the time. And through these mechanisms, the founders did, through ingenious ways, they accomplished what they had to accomplish to create a constitution for a free society. And my claim is that's all that a constitution still has to do for a free society in the modern world. And if we buy that argument, then I think the constitution does form this debt against the living today. So that's the case I try to make. You know, there's a bit more to it. I also talk about the popular sovereignty aspect and sort of the flaws in the founders that we hear about routinely today and how to think about that. Just very briefly, in case it spurs some questions, the book also talks about the founders' theory of liquidation, how to sort of fix ambiguous constitutional meaning over time. It talks a little bit about the difference between textualism and originalism. I take the somewhat idiosyncratic position that, I don't know if, Michael, if you share this with me, but I don't really think there's much of a difference between textualism and originalism. I seem to be one of only a few people in the world who doesn't see really a difference between the two of these. I defend original intent, sort of properly understood, at least as an input into the originalist process. I talk a little bit about lawyers' use of history, Brown v. Board of Education, and all, again, in under 135 pages. It's intended to be fun and accessible and, you know, pretty quick to read. So I promised I wouldn't take up too much of your time. I think I'll leave it there. Michael, I don't know if you have any comments or if you want to stoke some flames. Otherwise, we can we'll start with you, but otherwise happy to answer questions that anyone might have.
Well, let me just say this, that I don't disagree with any of that, but I do wonder if, Ilan, you might be misinterpreting the modern debate just a bit, in that I don't think you would get much argument from anyone on the left or among living constitutionalists or however you might want to describe your intellectual adversaries. I don't think you get much debate over the idea that there is a tension between having a forceful, energetic, effective government on the one hand and a protection for liberty on the other. What I think we have today is more of a disagreement about what kind of liberty we're talking about, because on the one hand, you have defense of the traditional liberties that I think are reflected both in the text and the original understanding of the Constitution, liberties such as the right of private property, such as the right of freedom of speech, even for speech that may be upsetting or offensive to some, such as the right of freedom of religion, even if the right of freedom of religion sometimes butts up against other popular ideas. Whereas, and I think that is a constitutionalist view that is strongly supported by a proper understanding of the text and history of the Constitution. I think the opponents are not arguing that there isn't such a balance, but they tend to disagree about what kinds of constitutional liberties are going to be protected. The right of private property is not particularly popular in many circles. It's viewed as an obstacle to a kind of redistributionist egalitarianism. The right of freedom of speech is under major assault on college campuses and elsewhere. The right of freedom of religion is also just in the last maybe 20 years become no longer something that is a common heritage of Americans, but rather as a flashpoint in our culture wars, like the case this term in the Supreme Court about the baker is an example of that. But on the other hand, we have assertions of kinds of freedom that are not so grounded in the Constitution. We almost unbounded sexual freedom, for example, is believed by many, and egalitarian freedoms of various sorts, the right to force other people to respect your own dignity is very high in the pantheon of modern of values. So we're a kind of social class-based egalitarianism based upon race, gender, sexuality, and now all kinds of intersectionality, that needs to be imposed not just as a restraint upon government, as the Equal Protection Clause would suggest, which after all says no state shall deny to any person the equal protection of the laws, but rather imposed upon your fellow citizens so that your fellow citizens are required to conform to certain notions of.
Michael might have dropped off. I know you're on a cell phone. Michael, are you still there? Okay, well, Michael, if you can hear me, we're having trouble hearing you. So I'll start a response, and then you can feel free to chime back in if we get you back. I hope you can hear us. So I think I agree with what you said. I'm not sure that it's a sort of the approach I take misinterprets that. I think there are a couple of elements that are at play here. First, there are this group of people who want, you know, say an Article 5 convention, either on the conservative or on the liberal side. You know, we have the Sandy Levinsons who think our Constitution is completely outdated and undemocratic and unjust, and so we should amend it. So we have people in that group, and then we have another group that want to interpret the existing Constitution in a certain way that gives play to these different views. As to the sort of that first group, the people who think the Constitution doesn't quite do what it has to do, or it has to protect more rights or be more democratic, I think the key insight that I try to convey in the book is nevertheless that any Constitution for a free society will have to strike this balance. And I'm trying to make the case that the balance the founders struck was a very good one. Now, when we listen, and when we listen to what advocates of these constitutional reform and these amendments say, it's quite contradictory. So on the one hand, because I don't think they openly recognize this tension that exists between self-government and liberty. And by the way, this goes back to sort of the progressive era where, you know, progressives were all for democratic accountability as long as it sort of resulted in the democratic social program, which is what they really ultimately meant by democracy. So, for example, we have the those who say, well, we've got to get rid of the Electoral College. We've got to get rid of the unrepresentative Senate, the equal representation in the Senate, because they're profoundly undemocratic. We need to become a better democracy. And then these same people out of the other side of their mouth say, oh, and we need a constitution that guarantees a right to health care for everyone, that guarantees a basic level of education for everyone, that guarantees a right to gay marriage or a right to abortion or whatever. In other words, the Constitution needs to be more democratic. We need to be better Democrats as long as we can't actually vote on things. like healthcare, education, you know, gay marriage, abortion, or what have you. And so, you know, I don't know if people really appreciate the contradiction here. The founders did, I think, appreciate the tension, even if not the contradiction. They appreciated the tension, and that's why they tried to create a government that would protect the rights most essential to a free people. And that's key. It protected the political rights, speech, petition, assembly, press, religious right, right to self-preservation, if you throw in the Second Amendment, the rights of criminal defendants. Before the state can exercise its state power to take away your life, liberty, and property, it has to have this due process mechanism, grand jury, trial of your peers, and so on. But other than that, they left most of these decisions for the democratic process. Because they knew we would evolve and progress over time, and they understood that there was a tension between taking things out of politics and creating sort of a Republican regime. So my claim in the book, anyway, is the founders did a better job than any of these scholars and politicians who seek to amend the Constitution in some of these ways. The second group of people are those that want to interpret the Constitution in a certain way that gives more weight to one of these facets of the Constitution or the other. So we have a lot of libertarians in the Federalist Society who I'm inclined to agree with politically, but who will often say that as an original matter, the Constitution requires these libertarian results because it cared about liberty. It was all about liberty and a classical liberal constitution. And, you know, on the other hand, you have some of the original conservatives who, I guess, weighted the presumption of constitutionality a bit too heavily because based on some democratic theory. And of course, I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. And this is along the lines of what I guess IJ would call judicial engagement, though I don't, you know, necessarily would agree with the results, the lower order results that they reached. But the answer is the Constitution was a balance between these two things. And the question is, what was that balance? And the progressives, by the way, their theory of interpretation is often about making the Constitution better. Better for democracy, a better democratic document. This is, you know, John Hart Ely. And so to bring it back, and then I hope, Michael, I hope you're back with us.
I think I'm back. Can you hear me?
So, yes, we can hear you. So the book tries to make the case that the founders' balance was a particularly good one, and we should be very, very wary before we try to change that balance. All right, Michael, take it away.
Well, I missed part of that. I apologize. I don't know what happened to my technology here, but I think that's right. But I think it's going to be a hard sell for many people who think that what you're talking about are old-fashioned rights, and they feel much more passionately about the rights of the moment.
That's certainly true, and you know the only answer I can give is I think the answer that all of us at the Federal Society sort of already know to give, which is that's why we have a democratic process that's so capacious, right? I like to say that the founders knew that we would progress and evolve over time, which is why they in fact left so much for the democratic process. So that, I mean, can you imagine if they had tried to write into the Constitution in 1789 things about abortion or things about gay marriage, if they, I mean, you know, homosexuality existed back then, and obviously they couldn't conceive of gay marriage at the time, but suppose they had said something about traditional marriage in the Constitution. There are good reasons why our Constitution doesn't do those things. It doesn't do those things because the founders knew we would progress and evolve over time. So they left room for that in the democratic process. So, I mean, I like to say that the Constitution may be dead, but I think the democracy our Constitution gave us is a living and breathing democracy. And maybe that's the argument that we should deploy, even though, again, it will not appeal to people who think the Constitution should require everything that they think is good and just in the world and prohibit everything that they think is bad in the world. But then can you really argue with those people at all?
Well, I think there's a deep confusion because many of the views that are very popular in progressive circles do not command a majority, and so among the population as a whole. And so it's interesting to know, you know, on what basis they are really arguing, because when you speak to them, they frequently say, well, we need to evolve with the times, but are the times what they think? Are the times what most people think? Are the times just what judges think? Evolving with the times raises more questions than it answers.
I certainly agree with that. Laura, is this a good time to, we're about halfway through, to see if there are any questions?
Yeah, let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Let's go to our first audience question.
I like the way you began your talk about your book with the Madison Jefferson argument. But I like the way you actually did explicitly address whether or not the Constitution is a positive or a negative benefit. Is it changed to be thrown off by today's society, in which case it would be a negative benefit and past generations owe something to us rather than we having a debt to the past generations? I think maybe something you want to consider is that probably the biggest problem the founders had was figuring out how to stitch all these separate states, several states together under one umbrella and form a new country. I think where your argument goes off the rails, and it's so common even amongst liberals, is I think originalism imputes an excessive value to the founders. It creates this myth that assumes greatness then is equivalent to greatness today, and it provides an excuse for us not to be great today. Look at the average mile time of, you know, just individual athletes and the way that's come down over time. But look at the development of the scientific method and other rigorous methodologies that exist today that didn't exist then. You know, Henry Ford's development of the Model T was ingenious, but nobody's driving a Model T today because we've progressed. And I think all this reverence for originalism in the Constitution and the founders really does a disservice to the current generation, because it makes us easy not to step up to the plate and take responsibility for governing our own times. I can provide you all sorts of challenges that exist today that didn't exist then, from the mass media, First Amendment environment, to we're blowing mountaintops off to get at coal underneath rather than going into mountains with shovels and pickaxes and muscles. We've got challenges today. I'd like you to address why you feel there is a debt to the founders rather than the founders, you know, putting chains on us today.
So those are all terrific comments. And there's this wonderful passage from James Madison in Federalist 14, which at first seems a bit in tension with his debt against the living letter to Thomas Jefferson. But I think they could be reconciled. And so in Federalist 14, he's responding to the charge made by those like Patrick Henry, those who fought in the Revolution of 1776, the anti-federalists who feared that the Constitution was sort of this repudiation of the revolutionary work that they had accomplished in 1776. And Madison says the following: "But why is the experiment of an extended republic to be rejected merely because it may comprise what is new? Is it not the glory of the people of America that whilst they have paid a decent regard to the opinions of former times and other nations, they have not suffered a blind veneration for antiquity, for custom, or for names, to overrule the suggestions of their own good sense, the knowledge of their own situations, and the lessons of their own experience? To this manly spirit," the manly spirit of 1776 he's talking about here, "to this manly spirit, posterity will be indebted for the possession and the world for the example of the numerous innovations displayed on the American theater in favor of private rights and public happiness." So what I think he's saying here is that all future generations, just as their generation did, have to be aware of their own circumstances, their own situations, and the lessons of past experience. Historical experience didn't freeze in time in 1776, and it didn't freeze in time in 1789. And so the only reason that Madison says that this manly spirit of change, the revolutionary change in 76, and then the constitutional change in 87, the reason we, the living, are going to be posterity, he says, are going to be indebted to these innovations is to the extent that they favor private rights and public happiness, to the extent that they are good innovations. And so I actually agree with you. If it's true that the founders' accomplishment in the Constitution is simply not relevant to today's problems, then we have to reject it. I agree with that. But I disagree with that, with the conclusion that the founders' accomplishment isn't relevant today. When it comes to balancing self-government and protecting rights, protecting only those rights most essential to a free society and protecting them vigorously, but leaving the rest for sort of capacious democratic choice, I think is all a free constitution has to do today. I don't know what else a constitution has to do. We might disagree with the balance that the founders struck, but even then, I think they struck a good one. And for what it's worth, when it comes to the really fundamental changes, we have changed the Constitution, obviously, to end slavery, to grant women suffrage, and the Constitution itself, for what it's worth, is written in phrases that make them adaptable. You mentioned all this technological innovation. Well, the Fourth Amendment applies to GPS devices the police officer puts on your car, right? It doesn't say we have a right to be safe and secure in our carriages, in our parchments, right? And so I think to a large measure, the Founders' Constitution continues to be successful for the modern world, and not just because we've had non-originalist glosses, but my case is the original Constitution would continue to be successful today, and to a large measure is why we have been successful.
Professor McConnell, would you like to add anything?
Well, the only thing I would add is that when you look at the real world of constitutional controversies, it is not by and large the originalists who are trying to tie the hands of current day legislatures. It's mostly progressive living constitutionalists who are doing that. Now, I don't want to say always, I say mostly. And what they try to do is to circumvent the democratic process and go to an elite core of judges to produce social change that they would not be able to win popular support for. And I don't see that as so much about appreciating the wisdom of today versus the archaic, backwardness of the founding, as it is a fight between an aristocratic elite and the people. And as to that, it seems to me that our Constitution, by and large, has a kind of a middle ground in which we don't have, popular democracy as if, we all take a vote the way, social media seems to operate. Instead, we elect representatives and they deliberate and they are the principal decision makers about social change. But we also don't delegate the authority to change society to people who are not accountable to the people. And when those folks tell us that things have to happen because they are in the Constitution, when no one ever thought that that was what the Constitution was going to be about, I think that they do a disservice, not just to constitutionalism and originalism, but to democracy as well.
We have about three callers waiting for questions, so let's go to our next questioner.
Thank you. This is James Lucas. I'd like to kind of take off of the comments that were just made. The reason that originalism arose as a kind of distinctive viewpoint is because the judiciary over the last 80 years has been moving us rapidly away, at least in my view, from the principles of the founding. I guess my question to Ilan would be, you know, what do we do to correct that? Obviously, you write excellent books about originalism, and we try to encourage people to appreciate the founding. But as a practical matter, we are where we are, and where we are, at least in my view, and I think some others share my view, is really quite far from the principles of the founding and the original public meaning of the Constitution. You know, one solution is to look to the judiciary, but in a judiciary which is relies on the common law concept of stare decisis, you know, we're limited, I think, in how much we can correct what has been done over the last 80 years. I mean, decisions like Wickard and Filburn or Everson and Board of Education are 80 years old now, and I don't see a court overturning them. So if that's not the case, what choice do we have but amendment? And if we are going to turn to amendment, you know, it doesn't work anymore. And do we not, you know, need to then reform it so that for the purpose of restoring the original meaning of the Constitution as opposed to engaging in new innovations? Or do you have a different view as to the solution to where we find ourselves, you know, today in 2017?
Thanks again for a terrific question. I would be remiss if I didn't jump on the opportunity to seize on your first point, which is that books like this do make a difference. And I'll shamelessly promote it here right now. It's again only 135 pages and only $15. It's pretty cheap, so it's not just good for you, but it's good for, you know, the people you know in college who are thinking about these things, people who are just starting law school and want to learn about this. And so it's writing accessible books. I mean, I love all my professors from law school, Professor McConnell, you know, you're terrific, but law professors don't always write in the most accessible way. So I think it's important to try to write for broader audiences. And I hope that this book can be a first among many for that. The second thing I'll say is that I wouldn't underestimate the judiciary. I know that the Federalist Society members have divergent views on the current administration, but there is certainly some sense to the "but Gorsuch" line of reasoning. I think every 8 years, what if it's a two-term president, they get to nominate and appoint about a third, a little more, I think, of the federal appeals courts. And obviously there might be more Supreme Court justices to come. And I wouldn't understate the impact that the court has in the popular culture and the popular imagination and how we think about law. I mean, we have individual district judges who are issuing nationwide injunctions, a power they never really exercised until the 1970s, to stop the entire administrative state and apparatus, the entire executive branch, in its tracks. And we listen to that. We care about that. It seems crazy. It seems crazy to people who deeply respect Article 3 and federal judicial power. But isn't it crazy that we let district judges get away with something like that? And it speaks to the profound influence that judges have in our system. And having another third of the judiciary take a more serious originalist line, who, you know, there are expectation interests. It's going to be harder to reverse some precedents than others, but we can, you know, certainly start little by little. I think, you know, I wouldn't understate that or underestimate the power of that. As for amending the Constitution, you know, as I said earlier, that always makes me nervous because I think, again, properly understood, the founders' accomplishment in the Constitution, especially as it's been amended and amended properly already, is good and binding and continues to do the work that such a constitution has to do for a free society. You know, maybe if we amended it to more clearly specify what we think or understand the original understanding and intent was, you know, that would be good. I'm not saying there aren't tweaks that could be made to the system still and other improvements, but I'm wary of that third option.
I really appreciate the question. Let me give one sort of minor point and then one bigger point. The minor point is don't be too dismissive of the last 80 years of judicial interpretation. It has not been all a catastrophe. A great many of the Supreme Court's decisions have vindicated the original principles of the Constitution. You know, I think we live in a world which is both better and truer to the original principles of the Constitution, that we have a Brown versus Board of Education, that we have a Sherbert against Verner, that we have protections for freedom of religion that the Supreme Court never had enunciated in the past, that the Takings Clause has been reinvigorated, that there are stronger protections for freedom of speech. So that's the minor point. Let's not be too pessimistic about the system. The other, Ilan talked about changes at the court level. I want to talk about changes at the popular level. And one thing that really, I think, needs to be done is to revive civic education so that young people will understand the basic principles of the Constitution. I am particularly concerned about the status of freedom of speech in American colleges and universities. And reputable surveys indicate that, you know, large numbers, even approaching a majority of college students, no longer believe that there should be freedom of speech for ideas that they disagree with. This is a really serious problem, and I think a great deal of it has to do with how poorly the principles of our system are now taught in high schools and in colleges. And this is something we all really could push for, that this doesn't mean whitewashing the past. We should talk about the blemishes of the past as well. But it's really, we have come to neglect teaching young people about the excellences of a system of a free republic and the principles that undergird it, and why things like freedom of speech, even for ideas that we disagree with, are so important.
Let's go to our next audience question.
This is David McFadden, a lawyer in Washington. I'd like Mr. Werman to discuss to what extent the living owe a debt to the framers of the 14th Amendment and owe proportionate obedience to their will, whatever that was.
So the whatever that was is a hard question, and probably Professor McConnell is actually a better person to answer that. In terms of the debt, it's a great one. When I say, you know, that the Constitution forms a debt against the living, we have to remember that it forms this debt against the living because it was an improvement upon what came before, an improvement worthy of veneration, worthy of respect, worthy of obedience. And then future changes can also be improvements of the same kind. Why is it, right, that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment are worthy of our respect and veneration today, even though, you know, women couldn't vote yet in the process, right? Not because the democratic process and the ratification process was perfectly legitimate, but because the content of what they created was an improvement upon what came before. And so I think there was an obvious original flaw, a major flaw in the original Constitution, that if it hadn't been corrected in the 14th Amendment, today probably would suggest that the Constitution, as originally understood, does not create that debt. I think that's probably right. I think for its time, it was an improvement upon what came before. We have to remember we don't celebrate the founders for the way they were like everybody else. They were obviously racist. They were all white male landowners. Many of them were slave owners. And those are all awful things, and we don't celebrate them for those things, right? We celebrate them for the way they overcame those many of those things and transcended those things in important ways. People forget that they wrote for the first time in a foundational national document that all men are created equal, and they forget that half the states abolished slavery between 1776 and 1789 as a result of that. You know, they forget that the founders abolished property requirements for holding federal office and abolished titles of nobility and hereditary privileges. So I think the Constitution did create this debt against the living in its time, and I think without the 14th Amendment, it probably would not today. So having said that, I think we owe a tremendous debt to the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments in that regard.
So I just say to the questioner, 100% yes, unequivocally yes, 14th, 15th, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments are, you know, not only just as authoritative, just as worthy of legitimate interpretation as any other part of the Constitution, but they really form, in a sense, the Second Republic. And, you know, this country would not be anywhere near as great a country as it is if we had not had the Civil War and resolved the Civil War with those amendments, which stand fundamentally for the equal rights of all people. That's it's not something we should be at all hesitant to embrace.
And let's go to our final pending question.
Hello. As you noted in your talk, you said that there was sort of an ideological disagreement between Madison and Jefferson on the understanding of the Constitution. And from what I gather on how original legal reasoning has to work, you sort of have to have an understanding of the founders' thoughts in the constitutional text to come to some sort of ruling. And it seems to me that's a pretty difficult thing to do. I mean, even if you look at, you know, John McCain versus Ted Cruz, I don't think they have the same intent or understanding when they're voting on similar things. And I'm sure you've gotten this question like 1,000 times before. I've never, I'm a college student. I've never had a professor even talk about originalist legal reasoning, so I haven't had anyone ever answer the question. So I guess I was wondering if you could help me out and just talk about how the justices can come to these sort of authoritative understandings of what the founders intended, especially when even like professional historians who work decades on these sorts of problems have difficulties coming to them, and when a dissent in a case like Heller can use historical grounds to disagree with an originalist opinion.
So first of all, thank you for being on this call and taking an interest in that. That was a terrific question, and one that, you know, I think sort of percolates in the back of people's minds a lot, but they don't always ask, and it's a very good one, and it's not the easiest one to answer. The first, but there are a few answers to it. The first thing that I'll say about the Jefferson and Madison disagreement, this is being a little unfair to Jefferson. I use Jefferson in this way because he thought about a constitutionalism differently, and today his letter is often taken for the proposition, some sort of non-originalist proposition, that we should be living constitutionalist. But I don't think Jefferson agreed with that. Jefferson's view was that the Constitution should be changed through things like a constitutional convention or constitutional amendments every generation or so. When it came to actually interpreting the Constitution, I actually think he was exactly like Madison. He was an originalist. Everyone back in the day was an originalist. That's just how they did law. It's how they interpreted contracts, statutes, treaties, and how they interpreted the Constitution. So there was sort of a wide agreement on that. What do we do with the problem of conflicting what I'll call conflicting specific intent? You know, if let's say we dig up evidence that, well, Madison really thought X, but Hamilton thought not X, you know, what do we do with that? So the first thing to say is that today, originalism stands for this idea that we should be governed by the original public meaning of the Constitution. So we don't look to specific intent as an initial matter. We look sort of to the original objective meaning of the words, but those words can only really be understood when we know the reasons for which they were written, the purposes for which they were deployed. So we do have to have some understanding of what the founders were trying to accomplish as a general matter, even if there was some disagreement about it. So, for example, we could know that as a general matter, the Constitution was intended to be binding directly on private citizens. and operate through private citizens rather than operate through the states, which was the flaw in the Articles of Confederation. And that's why, as originally understood, secession was unlawful, was unconstitutional. I mean, that's part of the case. So we can certainly discern things from the general purposes and general knowledge for which these provisions were written. And often that's enough. Often that's enough. And there will be wide agreement as to sort of the purposes for which these provisions were written. Now, sometimes we'll look at the public meaning of the Constitution, and it won't come up with it. You know, there won't be a clear answer. And I think many originalists do think originalism, one of its is more determinant than sort of other theories, and I think that's right. But I don't think it's all that determinant all the time. I mean, there are ambiguities, indeterminacies, vagueness. And then the question is, well, what do we do with that? What if it turns out people had different understandings and different intent in different ways? And then the answer is you kind of fight it out over time through the different political branches, through the courts over time, and one position tends to be vindicated. So a good example of this, and then I'll stop, is the debate over the constitutionality of the Bank of the United States. There was a debate in the Constitutional Convention over whether to have this power to incorporate a bank, and some people and they decided not to have this power. And so, you know, there's some evidence that some people thought that they wouldn't need this power because it's it's necessary and proper for these to effectuate these other powers, so we don't need it. Or I mean, obviously they can incorporate a bank or a corporation, and others seem to think that it the government shouldn't have that power. Okay, well, the Constitution's ambiguous as to whether the federal government can create a Bank of the United States. The specific intent of the different people, the convention, and you know, were kind of all over the place, and many of them were present in the first Congress debating this. And over time, they just had a debate, and one side won out. And the meaning, so to speak, of the Constitution became liquidated or fixed or ascertained over time. So it's a sort of a long and complicated way of saying most of the time we don't really have this conflict, because we just look at higher sort of we look at just the text, the public meaning of the text, the general purposes. But sometimes, you know, the text isn't clear, is ambiguous, and you do have these conflicting intents. And I think the best way we can deal with that is through this process of liquidation, not by courts just deciding the question, but all the political branches, the courts and the states sort of interacting together to come up with to settle the question.
There are, as the questioner indicated, there are, you know, some cases, and Heller, the gun rights case may be one of them, that are where it's really very hard to assess the actual original public meaning of a text like the Second Amendment. There are other questions where that's not hard at all, and I don't want to, we should not exaggerate the difficulty of the enterprise just because there are some really genuinely hard and unsettled questions. I would be perfectly, I would be joyous, I'd be doing handsprings if the courts were just to commit themselves not to do things that are plainly not the original understanding of the Constitution. And then when there are difficult questions with good arguments on both sides, they may be resolved through liquidation, as that means looking at interpretations over time, as Ilan suggests. That's one very good method. There are other possible methods as well, but as a starting point, I would just say let's not do things in the name of the Constitution that are not in the Constitution.
It looks like we have about a minute left in our teleform. Would either of you like to make closing remarks?
I've got nothing. Just wanted to thank everybody for taking this time out of your lunch period, especially if you're on the East Coast, and otherwise for joining us. Feel free to reach out if you have any other questions about the book or anything of that sort. And I also wanted to thank Professor McConnell for joining and the Federalist Society for hosting.
It's been a pleasure.
I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, December 15th at 1 p.m. Eastern, and that call will be a courthouse steps on Juliana of the United States. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email info@fedsoc.org. Reminder to go and buy Elon's book. And thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.